Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Deadhead Cannabis Show. I'm Larry Mishkin of the Hoban Law Group. And joining me today are my two co-hosts, Jim Marty of Bridge West. Jim, how are you doing today?
It's just a beautiful day here in Denver. I think we're going to hit 66 degrees and not a cloud in the sky. So I've been outside walking around, just beautiful outside.
Can't beat that. And our other co-host, Rob Hunt of Linnae Holdings. Rob, how are you doing out in California? I suppose you're going to have a similar statement for us too, aren't you?
For once, Larry, I don't. It's actually a rainy day out here. It's relatively cold, and we've got a lot of our windows open today to let the cool breeze in. But I am locked in my office writing contracts all day, so unfortunately I'm not out and about, and really wishing I was in the mountains of Colorado right now.
Yeah, that sounds like the place to be. It's bright and sunny here, 50 degrees, but it's just a big mush puddle with all the snow that we've had that's just melting all over the place. So we've got a really, really exciting show today. Rob, give the listeners a quick rundown on what we're going to be talking about.
So today's a fun day for us because the topic is a good festive one. We're going to talk about in the springtime how the Grateful Dead would often open up their year by either playing a Chinese New Year's run or a Mardi Gras run, oftentimes in their hometown of either Oakland or San Francisco. And talking about how that was, you know, frequently the time that the Grateful Dead would introduce new material for the year, and oftentimes, almost always, bring out some sort of a fun guest, whether it was, you know, New Orleans royalty like the Neville Brothers or the Dirty Dozen Brass Band. But it was always a time where they'd bring in some fun guests to play alongside with them. So we were going to talk about the fun that was always Mardi Gras.
Excellent, excellent. And we have a special guest on our show today, Will Reed of Canna Planners. Canna Planners does a whole lot, so what I'm going to do is take this opportunity to introduce Will to our listeners. Will, thank you so much for joining us on our show today. We're very happy to have you here. Give us a little bit of background on yourself, what Canna Planners is all about, and how you got from wherever you were to where you are today.
Okay, I'll see if I can sum it up real quickly. Well, I'll start kind of in the middle. I started Canna Planners in 2015 after a trip out to Colorado just to check. So I'm a Vermonter, so I was thinking about starting a company in Vermont, and at the time I was kind of seeing how the a potential legal industry was going to play out in Vermont. It took 5 years to play out, but it finally played out. But in the meantime, I was curious how I could be in this industry, which, you know, I had admired as a business person, but as a piece of my life and as a cultural component of kind of who I am, cannabis has always been important. So I come from a marketing background, and upon taking this trip to Colorado, and again, this is years ago, was shocked with how bad everything looked, how unsettling the retail experience was. I'll add to that context that I'm also a former Apple employee for many, many years in Manhattan. And so I was, you know, beaten with the stick of brand and retail experience and all of these things. So just going out to Colorado, I kind of expected something wonderful, and it was a little weird. Fast forward to now, everything's an Apple store and everything kind of, you know, looks fancy and clean. But back then, not so much. So coming back to Vermont and knowing that in the Northeast, things were about to happen in Massachusetts, in Maine, certainly. All these states were starting to pick up legalization or new medical laws. So I wanted to be a part of, a part of the industry. So websites, you know, that was my background. That was my agency background, creating digital, you know, working digital marketing solutions for clients of all types. And what I wanted to do was give that service to just the cannabis industry. So that's what we did. Yeah, and like I said, and prior to that, I was working at a web agency, and prior to that, I was working for Apple for a long time. And we will talk about when we get into the Grateful Dead side of this. My time at Apple will come back around, how Apple influenced my deadheadedness.
So Canna Planners is, if I understanding it correctly, it's not even just an ad agency. You're really committed to helping shape the discussion on what the cannabis industry is and what it's all about.
Certainly. Like, that's my superhero costume is, you know, so at the root of it, our services are, we build websites, we create brands, we apply those brands to cool things like products or signage or or whatever, you know, sweatshirt, stuff, everything, whatever the client needs. And then we, you know, we put those companies online on a managed platform that we've created. And then we do whatever they need us to do to help them market themselves online. And because of cannabis, and I'm sure we'll get into this too, but because of restrictions within the industry, there's restrictions to what we do. So our bread and butter in terms of digital marketing is SEO and email marketing. We do lots of video production and stuff like that too. But
well, that made me think of some questions, Jim here. So, you know, every state is a silo, right? There's no cross-border traffic, whether it's medical or adult use. What is your opinion on that limiting a national brand?
Well, let me answer that question a little. Let me put that question onto me as a growing company in the industry, because I would say that it actually presents a really comfortable and I'd even say responsible trajectory for growth, right? Like, we can only grow as quickly as states legalize, right? So from a CBD perspective, we can market everybody nationally and even internationally to some extent. The places where our clients are is based off of the you know, legalities and whether or not that state's adopted any legalization laws.
Well, Will, let me ask you a question about that.
Sure.
One of my big issues with legal cannabis is this whole idea of normalization. So it ties in exactly to what you're saying. And, you know, we could have a guy like Jim talk for hours about, you know, where a state like Colorado is right now in terms of the role that illegal cannabis plays in Colorado and how it's as commonplace as, you know, going down to the store to buy a quart of milk. But in the rest of the country, it's not really quite like that. And, you know, you take a state like Illinois, which has had an adult use program for a year, and we're kind of slowly but surely working our way towards normalization, and we'll get there eventually. But that's one way I see you helping. But the other way is you take some of these other states that haven't legalized yet. And, you know, they're on the fence and they're not sure what to do. And, you know, I think it's just as important, you know, for guys like you to be able to help the rest of us send the message to them, to the people in those states that, you know, it's okay to vote yes. It's okay to say we want legalization. You know, you're not going to all go running out and turn into schizophrenics. You know, you're not going to, you know, abandon your children. You can lead a very normal life and enjoy cannabis.
Totally. I have definitely a couple responses to that. The first being is I put an incredible amount of responsibility, you know, just self-imposed weight on the shoulder, you know, my shoulders, but also my team, my team's shoulders in terms of how we want our clients to position themselves, right? So being transparent, having direct lines of communication, providing, you know, certificates of analysis, FDA disclaimer, like all of these things are very important, and we push heavily onto our clients because that's part of normalization. The other side of it is the design side of it. So in my trip to Colorado, one thing I know, you know, and you guys have seen this, I'm sure all the listeners have seen this, the green cross is everywhere, the pot leaf is everywhere, that bright green is everywhere, right? So a lot of these things, while they represent things we love, and they are used in lots of ways, and in lots of ways they're used, you know, it's fine. Those kind of design, I call them tropes, you know, right? Those design tropes haven't helped release stigma, and there's a lot of work to be done there. So there's a certain design aesthetic that we try to maintain professional, and that's not to say we don't use the pot leaf and that color green doesn't come into play sometimes, but it's not our go-to. And for sure, getting off that crutch is going to be a huge part of normalization. The other thing I'll say, Larry, is CBD has been an incredible boon. It's been an incredible hit to the normalization path, right? You know, cannabis light, diet cannabis, you know, and of course it's not, but I'm being flippant. But what I mean is, like, it's just an easier, more accessible access point for people who may have been really impacted by the war on drugs, by the immense negative marketing campaigns of the last 80 years against cannabis as a, you know, quote, drug. So CBD has been a big part of not only growing the industry, but really just being an entry point for you know, recreational or medical, for sure.
Jim, let me ask you a question really fast. You know, and I alluded to this before. As a guy who was there at the very beginning in Colorado and really helped usher it into the state, what would you say are the one or two things that you saw people in the industry do, and how do you counsel your clients to help kind of promote this idea of normalization?
Well, that's a good question. Yeah, at the beginning, we were all sort of feeling our way around in the dark. The way I put it is that there wasn't any book we could go to. We relied heavily on California because they had medical marijuana since 1996. And so we looked at them for, you know, cultivation, extraction, you know, retail models. But in many, many ways, we were inventing it on our own. And some of those businesses were very, very successful, made a lot of millionaires. Many, many failed as well. Because the way I put it is, we threw a lot of spaghetti against the refrigerator and some of it stuck, but a lot of it fell off. For Will, I appreciate all that you're saying, because I have my own opinions on federal normalization, if you will. I hate to say the word federal legalization because, as I've said many times, who's the first federal agency that's going to come visit you, your right. cannabis business, if we go federal?
I've heard your opinions on this, Jim, and I will say that for the most part, I'm actually on board with you. I think that there will always be, I don't want to call it a black market, although it is in a lot of, you know, for sure it is, but let's call it a farmer's market, right? Like, I think that there will always exist this opportunity on a neighborly scale to, you know, share the bounds of our harvest without having to go to a retail store. Now, with that said, I'm totally for full federal legalization because, I mean, for what I think are obvious reasons, you know, I mean, huge social impacts, arrests of, you know, the destruction of hundreds of thousands of lives, countless people in jail for low-level drug offense, like all of that stuff, you know, like it just makes sense. We're at a time where the states are having, weirdly enough, I would say, and I'm specifically talking about cannabis now, I don't want to like overreach, but states are having, you know, a more responsible outlook. And I would say mostly states do on social circumstances. Yeah. But
and I do have a quick federal update. There's, I think, been three bills that have passed the House, installed in the Senate. And now it looks like in the Senate, there's talk of combining the banking, the state's bill, which would basically decriminalize, not legalize, but decriminalize cannabis at the federal level, and a fix on tax deductions, IRS code section 280E. There's talk of the Senate rolling all those into one bill. So there's a little bit of a federal update that I just talking to a colleague about in the last day or so.
Very cool.
Well, now that a certain senator from the state of Kentucky is, you know, not holding as much power as he used to, it's possible that these things actually make more momentum than they have in the past.
Hey, Rob, let me bring you in here for a minute. You really have, I think, your finger on the pulse of the national market as well as anybody. And I'm really kind of curious as to what your thoughts are on exactly what's going on and how you see the market growing.
Yeah, well, there's now a new senator that holds a great deal of power from West Virginia. So, you know, it might not be a Senate majority leader, but it's certainly a Senate blocker on a lot of different programs. And, you know, it remains to be seen whether or not we can still get a bill through the Senate based on the composition of the Senate today. You know, we certainly have the motivation, you know, from our vice president to see a bill get done. As I said before, Cory Booker is certainly put in the right position to oversee, you know, certain regulatory agencies. So I'm more bullish than I've been, but I'm certainly not bullish in, you know, near-term prospects of anything going through. And as I said, you know, 2 weeks ago I had, you know, Graham Boyd and Khursheed Khoja and Chris Crane and a handful of other people that run NCIA and run SSDP and run Normal, Evan Nissen from Normal. And the prevailing belief from all of them is that we're still, you know, 3 to 5 years, if not further out from full-blown federal legalization, despite the composition of the current Senate and the current executive branch. So, yeah, I don't think people should be overly excited. I think incrementally we'll see a great deal of change. And we talked about this, you know, New York, I think, is a foregone conclusion this year. Where Will is in Vermont, you know, that went through the State House last year. And, you know, that was a great one to see. And certainly as of today, I think they just announced that 20 new towns in Vermont have opened up and said yes to recreational cannabis. So incrementally, we're still seeing the changes we want to see, and I don't think that, you know, we should be overly focused on federal legalization as long as the ball's moving in the right direction and it's not hampering the ability of the industry to move. I'd like to see, the States Act go through. I'd like to see 280E repealed. But other than that, I'm perfectly comfortable keeping the wolves at bay for a while longer and watching the experiment continue, where a lot of the craft growers and a lot of the guys in Northern California or the smaller towns in Colorado, have multiple years to really get their businesses fully functional before they, get attacked by outside capital.
Well, that's the thing about this thing moving slowly, is that it does allow for smaller companies to try to make an impact before the big ones come in.
It does. And I know that's a point that Jim has often made in terms of be careful what you wish for with respect to getting full legalization. Right, Jim?
Yes. Yeah, I was in Washington, D.C. a number of years ago, and a very prominent congressman, he said, Congress, the House, the Senate, we're at least 5 years behind public opinion, and that's intentional. We move very slowly here. We want to get everybody in line. We want to get all the facts. We want to let various coalitions come together before we move forward. So we do have a slow-moving federal government, and I believe, from what this congressman told me, it was built to be that way.
Yeah, I'll tell you my minor victory of the week, Jim, is that as of 2 days ago, Matt Gaetz now follows me on Clubhouse in my Ask Me Anything About Cannabis Club. And while I might not agree with a single thing that's ever come out of Matt Gaetz's mouth, I love the fact that he might be an audience member for some of my talks, where I can actually try to influence how he does feel about the cannabis industry. When you start getting, far right Republican congressmen that are listening and trying to figure out what's happening within the industry, I think that's good for all of us.
I think you're right.
Rob, I just wanted to touch on something you mentioned earlier about Vermont. So when Vermont passed their adult use bill, it was set up like a lot of legalization bills to give provisional, a provisional head start to the medical companies that have.
Yeah, like my buddy Shane Lynn at Champlain Valley.
Totally. So what some of the new votes that you just touched on, it's called Town Meeting Day. Every town in Vermont, comes together in the town hall or the school gymnasium or whatever, and they vote on, the local things that town needs. Do we get a new traffic light? Who's the new, cop? Whatever, all that stuff. Mrs. McGillicuddy's cow keeps, getting in the road, all of these things. So in regards to S-54, the legalization bill, a lot of towns voted whether or not they would opt into having retail stores in their towns. And some of them, the ones that voted yes, of those, a few of them rewrote the bill to exclude that head start. So there will be even smaller craft cannabis companies existing at the same time Shane Lynn opens his recreational doors too, which is a great thing. I'm really psyched about that.
And the thing I love about Vermont is Vermont's always been a very liberal state, but they've always had, a Republican governor. Phil Scott right now being at the helm is a good thing. But then you've got David Zuckerman, who I've known for years, who's been one of the strongest proponents of cannabis change I've ever met, from back in the time when he was just an alderman.
Yeah, so it was a bummer he's not around right now.
Yeah, it is. It's very much a bummer. And then obviously, having TJ as your attorney general, another guy who's a very pragmatic guy that I used to work for in the Vermont, in the Chittenden County District Attorney's Office when he was an assistant AG. And TJ's absolutely the right guy to be at the helm. So you've got some terrific people in Vermont politics that, really think about the way the state should be run. It's no surprise that, the movement happened out of the state house in Vermont rather than, in other ways. But, if I think about all the states that are super pro cannabis, Vermont and Oregon have always come to my mind as, the ones that have always been supportive, which is why you've gotten so many great jam bands coming out of Vermont, and why you've had much music, happening on Church Street and in Battery Park and all the other places, that make Vermont so special.
Totally. That's how and maybe we'll get into this further down the line, but that's how I found myself in Vermont. I was a young hippie graduate of St. Lawrence University in upstate New York, and I started a band there. And, where do hippie bands go when they graduate from college? They go to Boulder or Burlington.
That's what Grace Potter and Matty Burr did.
And they were in my band before they started their own thing.
Matt Burr was in your band. I grew up with Matt Burr. That's awesome, man.
Yeah. Matt Burr was in my band. Yeah, for sure.
Well, that's a great segue to move our conversation over to the musical side of things. And I saw in your bio you've been to over 100 Phish shows, and I'm probably in the same category there, seen them a lot. And I actually got to Coventry back in 2004.
Yeah, same. It was a depressing weekend. It was rainy and sad, but still a good time.
A lot of mud.
Yeah, but that's, you know, par for the course.
It was. I have a quick Coventry story. So my Coventry story is, it was the same weekend as my 30th high school reunion. So I'm dating myself. But I stayed sober, and I drove my friends home at midnight, and I said, I'm headed for Vermont. I'm headed for Coventry. This was from Hanover, Mass., about a 4 or 5 hour drive. My friends are, you're crazy. You're not leaving now? You're going to the show? I said, yeah, I'm jumping on the highway right now, and I did. I drove through the night, hit that traffic, that Coventry traffic, but I'd been to Bonnaroo several times, and I knew some of the tricks. So I just stayed in the left-hand lane of the highway, drove past Coventry, and it turns out the actual event was in the next town over. It wasn't actually in Coventry. Do I have that correct, Will?
Yeah, I think in Newport, maybe.
Anyway, I drove past the traffic, drove past Coventry. I got off the highway, and the locals were saying, hey, $15, you can park in my yard. So I did, and this lady came up to me, and I'd just driven through the night. It was about sunrise at this point. And she comes up to me, goes, $15, you can park here. $50, you can get a room in my grandma's house. So I said, I'll take that. So I jumped in, got 4 or 5 hours sleep. Her husband, I left my car there. Her 80-year-old husband drove me to the gates of Coventry. I bought a ticket from a man from Japan, and I was in the show.
There you go. That sounds like a pretty typical Phish story.
Yeah, sounds like a typical Phish story.
Madness in order to get in the gates. That's how it always is for me. Every time, even, you know, from when I was a kid, even till, you know, recently, it's always some mad dash for something magical, but it's always worth it.
Well, some people criticize that the band didn't play that well at Coventry, but it had its moments. And You Enjoy Myself, I think that ended the first set. And there was a really wonderful David Bowie first night, first set. So it had its moments. But the band was probably not at its best that weekend.
When you see Trey crying on, it's like when you, when you see your dad cry for the first time. When you see Trey cry on stage, it's like, oh, no, you, not you.
Right. And here's my question about that, right? Because we have a situation where you went to a concert, everybody kind of knew that, at least for the time being, they were saying goodbye. And, you know, we all hoped and assumed that there would be a next round, but at the time, nobody knew for sure. And as a deadhead, maybe in 1974, right before they took their year off, but it wasn't the same, you know. In other words, as deadheads, we never really had an opportunity to go to a show knowing, for better or for worse, that this was the last show. Some of us just happened to be in Soldier Field for what turned out to be the last show. But, you know, and maybe we were crying because Jerry's performance had dropped dramatically, and we were, you know, hoping that maybe he would take some time off and bounce back. But that's a very interesting mindset to go to see this band. I imagine it was probably like going to The Last Waltz, right, when you're going in to see the band play their final show. And as they play each song, it's like, wow, this is great, but that's it.
Yeah, you'd never know that, you know, some of those guys in the band were unhappy, because that's one of the best recorded concerts I've ever heard in my life, you know, that show. And, you know, that's those are pros right there.
Yeah.
I will say, Larry, there's nothing more, you know, and because I have both of these experiences of, you know, it was fun, but it was sad being in at Coventry. But then flash forward to 2009 in Virginia, and I was there for those three nights. And when the lights dropped and, you know, and those guys walked on stage, it's as if that place was going to, you know, and they call it the mothership. It was as if that place was going to lift right off the ground. It was like redemption.
Hampton comes alive.
Well, so A, they opened with Fluffhead, right? Fluffhead, which be like the Dead coming out and opening with St. Stephen. So,
exactly.
I mean, that was pretty cool. And yeah, the Hampton Coliseum, I saw more than my share of Dead shows there, including the breakout of Box of Rain that they had there in 86, I want to say. So That was the place to see. We drive halfway across the country to see them there. That was a great, great place. We really liked it a lot.
Right.
A lot of fun.
I saw formerly known as the Warlocks there.
Oh, you saw the Warlocks show in 89 there?
It was in spring of 92, actually.
Oh, 92. Okay, I don't know why I was thinking 80. Right, formerly the Warlocks, and they did their show, yeah. That was a lot of fun also. That was a lot of fun.
We have Phish back, and they're healthy and sober and playing great. Although, when I listen to some of their early shows, I'm amazed. You know, this was before I started seeing them. I think my first Phish show was 95. How good they were at the beginning, in the very early years.
Yeah, they slayed. They crushed it. Those 90s, you know, those 90s years are the, for Phish nerds, those are the fabled years, you know, and in like the cow funk era of, you know, the Vermont jam cow funk stuff and all those years. My first show was in 94. I was 13 years old. It was my first concert. And it was actually recently featured on the Dinner and a Movie thing. It was the, it's actually like a, you know, in the world of Phish, a kind of a famous show. And it was Great Woods in 94. And it was their the last Game Henge show, the show where they played the last full Game Henge set. And that was my first concert and my first Phish show. Yeah. And my dad was in the parking lot reading a book. And now I can't even think what he was thinking. You know, my dad's pretty straight laced, but you know, he's sitting in the parking lot reading, a Winston Churchill biography or something like that. And he's, you know, he's surrounded by weird Phish people, weird hippies, you know, and the whole spectacle. So who knows what he thought?
Well, I'll tell you. You know, that's really a lot of fun. You know, you talk about the early years, and they did. They killed it in the early years. But, you know, guys, that reminds us of our conversation last week, right? And we were talking about the 69 shows, and we had even talked before that about, you know, the earlier Avalon ballroom shows. And I think there is something magical about those early years for these bands when they're first finding their legs and really, you know, really, really making it happen. And just, you know, so that we all know, we did talk about it in our last episode for anyone who wants to go back and listen to it, all about those 69 shows. And sure enough, this week, I just, in fact, wrapped it up last night with the fourth of the four shows from the Fillmore. And I have to tell you, once a year, I take the time to listen to all four of them. And each year, it's more fun than the next. So, you know, that early magic for any of these bands is great stuff and a lot of fun to listen to.
Yeah, it's really fun to see a band put in the work. Like, that's the stuff I love seeing.
My biggest year of Phish was 1991. I saw the entire Giant Country Horde tour. I think I might have missed one show that summer tour, and I worked at Arrowhead Ranch that summer. So, you know, you want to talk about just a tour that was unbelievably fun to be on. It ended in Amy's Farm and, you know, played the Townsend State, or Townsend Park, and Berkshire Performing Arts Center and Keene, New Hampshire.
Oh, man, you're bringing it back for me. I see all my Maxell 90s from that entire tour in my mind's eye.
That was by far my biggest year for Phish. I'll tell you quickly, my Coventry story is I was not there, but they simulcasted at the time. And for years, you know, I knew that one of my best friends growing up, his older sister had gone to Taft and gone to UVM with Trey. And he'd always said they were such close friends. And we always kind of just discounted it. And we're like, yeah, you know, maybe you were, maybe you weren't. And then that night, Trey played Wolfman's Brother and did the explanation of Wolfman's and talked about the line, the telephone's ringing, I handed it to Liz. And he goes, it's Liz Durfee who I was talking about. And if you hear the tape, and all of us were like, no way. It really, like, you know, because my good buddy was Chris Durfee. So to hear, like, Trey on stage at the final show, what we thought was the final show, come out and say that line was written about Liz Durfee, all of us, like, stared at each other like, he was telling the truth the whole time. So it was really funny. That was my Coventry moment from the living room of my house in Boston at the time.
That's awesome. That's a lot of fun. But here, before we run out of time, I want to make sure that we don't lose track of the other topic that we lined up here today, Rob. And I know you put a little bit of time into it at the outset, and that's that we're at a time of year for Deadheads when, notwithstanding the fact that we're, you know, 25, 30 years post-Jerry now, this still is when people would start to think about the next year of a Dead cycle, right? We'd always end it on the New Year shows, and then typically we'd get the Chinese New Year shows in late January, followed by the Mardi Gras shows in late February. And they were great shows because they were usually two or three off, not part of a tour. So really good energy for the band, played at home. So there was no travel issues for them. They'd break out new stuff. And, you know, they each had their own thing, right? The Chinese New Year show, they'd always have the Dragon Dance, which was awesome. And the Mardi Gras show was, well, that was freaking Mardi Gras. They brought it to San Francisco. So, you know, that was great too. But did you have any experiences in any of those shows?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Let's move away from you know the sadness of Coventry, and let's talk about the celebration of the Grateful Dead in the you know February and March time. I caught Chinese New Year in 1992, which is when they broke out the New Speedway Boogie for the first time since 71. I got the that might have been 91. 92 is when they broke out all the new tunes like you know So Many Roads and Wave to the Wind and Karina. You know, I saw them play with Ornette Coleman one of those times. I saw them play with Ayrto Marina multiple times.
Wow.
Like, that was the time of year where like, if they were going to bring new material out and they were going to test it before they took it out on spring tour, they brought it out then.
Yep.
Some of the best nights of my life were in the Oakland Coliseum in, you know, 91, 92, 93. So I'm looking at some of those right now, and you had one Chinese New Year. One year, I think that they did both Chinese New Year and Mardi Gras, and then a couple of Mardi Gras. But then I think back to the ones I missed, and I think about the ones in the late 80s where, you know, they either brought out Cyril Neville or they brought out the Dirty Dozen. You know, so one of the shows I asked Will to take a listen to, and by the way, I love the fact that Will, when he thought we were listening to a different show, came back and he's like, "You're going to make me listen to an audience recording? Come on, man, don't waste my time." And then when I sent him the one I wanted to listen to today, his reaction just came back. He's like, "A soundboard, thank you." So I had you listen to, I think it was the 1987 Mardi Gras with the Ico with the Dirty Dozen. So what did you think of that one, Will?
I was so stoked. Well, because I was listening to that first show. And I'll listen to an audience recording, but you can't hear vocals. You can't hear Jerry. Like, you can't hear the high end of, you know, the pianos and stuff like that. So when you sent me this new show, I was really psyched. Not only because it was a soundboard recording, but because of the set list. On paper, I mean, this was an awesome show. On paper, this could be like the best show I've ever seen in terms of set list. This has all of my favorite, my favorite Bobby songs. It has my favorite Grateful Dead song on it. And that's hard to say. I have like 100 favorite Grateful Dead songs, but it has my absolute Mississippi Half Step is my favorite Grateful Dead song. That's on this set list. And then the second, you know, the last, you know, right after Drums in Space, that whole 2, 4, 5 songs there, you know, well, the last four songs, Wharf Rat and Throwing Stones, Touch of Grey, broke, like, are you kidding me? That what an amazing set list. But I was really psyched to discover, you know, the Dirty Dozen Brass Band on this, because, you know, my experience with the Dirty Dozen Brass Band is
Panic.
A little more contemporary. And I was like, who is, you know, I had to research. I was looking back and I was like, who's this horn section? And it took them a minute to get it all figured out. Like, I noticed, Billy and Mickey were a little soggy in there for a second, but once it like got in, like it was perfection. It's such a good set. I'm glad this is the show you sent me.
And you can't have a Mardi Gras without an Ico. I mean, just
no,
saying.
It definitely is. Not.
Well, but it's more than that, Rob. To me, Ico was my second show ever in Syracuse in 1982. Our brains were clearly in another place at the time, and they came out of space into Ico. And at that moment, I just decided I love the Grateful Dead and I love Ico. And then it always became a challenge, you know, where could you catch up with it? And I always figured if they were playing it, it just meant that Jerry was in a good mood, you know, and kind of like that little playful, you know, call and response mood that goes with it and everything. But yes, on Mardi Gras, it's an automatic. And this, I've heard this one before, especially because of the Dirty Dozen Brass Band. And it's got that real Mardi Gras growl to it. But what I like is, you know, the thing about Ico is you can find three different people and they'll all sing it differently.
I was going to say the same thing, Larry. I noticed that they were singing different lyrics than Jerry would normally sing. Yet Jerry still sang the lyrics that he sings.
I was just going to say the history of Ico is it was a New Orleans street march, traditional New Orleans street music.
As is, you know, much of the stuff like that they do that they've taken and grabbed to their own. And if you check out Ico, You know, it's got an interesting history in terms of who's credited as the writer. My introduction to it was by the Dead at that Syracuse show, but I immediately then ran out and bought Dr. John's album Gumbo because he's got a great version of Iko on there. And I have a tape from a 1984 show at Brendan Byrne with Stephen Stills, who came out and played with the boys. And out of space, they played a song called Black Star, and then they played it into Iko, and he sings a couple of the verses. And I had never heard the verses sung the way he sang them. So, you know, I just love that about the song. I think even Aaron Carter recorded it once when my kids were younger. They had a, you know, one of those greatest hits for pop singers, and there was an Aaron Carter version of it, and even he couldn't screw it up. You know, it's just too much of a fun tune.
It's a jam.
It is. And when you hear it, you know that everybody's just in a good mood. And this version with the Dirty Dozen Brass Band, yeah, they're having a great time, Rob. This is a great call.
So good. Yeah, and I was particularly happy because it's a Brent show, and Brent's my favorite. I love that dude.
We talked about that last week, too.
So, Tons of Steel, like, not a song, you know, I looked it up. They only played it 20-something times or something like that.
But Tons of Steel stands out for me because...
It's so good.
He's got the very, very brief harmonizing with Phil.
Oh, my God.
Couldn't travel as fast as speed of rumor flies. These wheels are bound to trump the track. And him and Phil, all of a sudden, and it's like, I loved it when they'd play that song because Phil would step up to the mic and harmonize with them. And it was just, you know...
That's my guy. So I never, you know, I never got to see the Grateful Dead. I grew up going to see...
I wasn't going to out you, but I'm glad you outed yourself.
I never got to see him. I had a ticket to go see them at the Boston Garden in 1995, September of 1995.
Me too.
I wish I still had that ticket because that'd be something. But, you know, it was right before they tore down the Boston Garden. And obviously, you know, Jerry died in August of 95. So, you know, I didn't get to see them. So I grew up going to see... You know, Phil Lesh and Friends and Fish, as I said, but also, yeah, Rat Dog and Dark Star and all those bands. And, you know, I always gravitated more towards the Phil and Friends scene. Like, that's what I love to see. So fast forward to being in New York City and working for Apple. Because I had this, I don't know why, I got chosen to be, I think it's because I came from Apple from a band. But they asked me to be like the celebrity guy. So I, you know, I sold stuff to Lou Reed, and I'm a big guy, and Lou Reed comes up to like my belt. So it was always fun, like seeing him, rest in peace, Lou Reed. But Trey was a customer of mine, and wow. We'll save those stories for another time. But, one day I'm at my store, and someone comes and gets me and says, "Hey, there's someone here that you need to see." And I walk downstairs. I don't know if you guys have ever had this moment where you meet celebrities or maybe even members of the Grateful Dead. And you're like, you look at them and you're like, I know you. You're like, oh, what's up? You know, like you see them and you're because, you know, you have the context of seeing their band 40,000 times or seeing them on TV or whatever it is. So I had that experience where I was, you know, Phil Lesh is standing at the bottom of the stairs of the Apple store where I work and needs an iPhone. And I was asked to sell him an iPhone. And I just had that experience of just being like, oh, hey, what's up, Phil? Like, good to see you again. How you doing? You know what I mean? So I sold him an iPhone. I sold him and his wife, Jill, iPhones. And... 2 days later, I'm in my apartment in Brooklyn, and my wife and I are having dinner or something, and my phone's next to me, and I look down, and it says, it's ringing, and it says Phil Lesh on my phone, and I'm like, oh my God, he's calling me right now. And of course, he was just calling to be like, hey, Will, how do I set up my email on my phone or whatever it was? You know, like, I can't connect to Wi-Fi, Will. What do I do? But it was just like, it was like, you know.
I have to ask, were you like, I'll tell you the answer to that if you tell me why you shelved Box of Rain until 86.
Yes. Yes.
No. No. And this is the reason I worked with the celebrities, because... I was cool as a cucumber. On the inside, I was freaking out, you know, freaking out. But I would just be like, yeah, Phil, you just go to settings and, you know, just tap the thing and hit Gmail. You're good to go. But inside, I'm like, ah! You know.
Sure, of course.
But what did happen is we kind of became friendly. I worked with him a bunch of times. He gave my wife and I passes to, we saw them at the Brooklyn, where the Brooklyn Cyclones play. And we had, you know, laminates and all that stuff. He gave us backstage passes to the Garden. So this is where my story gets stupid. This is where I turn into the fan. Okay. The crazy person. So Phil Lesh of the Grateful Dead, one of my all-time heroes, puts my wife and I on the guest list at Madison Square Garden, the greatest venue on the planet Earth, probably in the entire universe.
Yeah.
Right? So we get there, and we live in Brooklyn, and so we take the F train right up to the Garden and walk right in and go up to the window and say, I'm Will Reed. I'm on a list. And they look at the list. They're like, no, you're not. Get out of here. And I'm like, no. I'm on there. I'm definitely on there. And they're like, no, you're not. See you later. So I'm standing in the middle of the Garden without tickets to a show I definitely want to do. And I did this. It turned out fine. But I did the stupidest fan thing, which is I texted the rock and roll star who was 40 minutes from going on stage at the biggest venue. I texted Phil and I said, hey, Phil, those tickets aren't at will call. Can you send somebody? And sure enough, like 5 minutes later, we had our tickets and we were in. And I love that man. Like that man can call me any time of day and ask me how to set up his iPhone. I haven't worked at Apple for 10 years, but I'll do anything he asks.
That's great.
Well, that's a great story, Will. And I agree 100% with what you're saying. For 7 or 8 years, I was a rock and roll photojournalist. I got to meet Phil and I got to meet Trey and lots of other famous musicians. I got John Poplar a glass of water at Bonnaroo. I was always in the spirit of Hunter S. Thompson. I always made sure I was the most fucked up one in the press tent. But I had a great time with it. So I agree with everything you're saying. It's like, yeah, I know you. Yeah. I've listened to your music for years. How you doing?
Same with Trey. I was walking down the stairs at the Cube of Fifth Avenue, you know, the most famous Apple store. And I was walking down the stairs, and it was the middle of winter. And I turned to my left, and Trey was right next to me walking. And I just said, oh, hey, what's up, man? Just like that. And he's like, hey, how you doing? And, like, that was that. And then I, you know, similar things happened where I got to meet Trey. And, you know, he, you know, is my hero. Like that's the guy I started seeing when I was 13, right? So surreal experiences, man. Surreal experiences. Sometimes they're out there, you know, like you just gotta look for them. They're there. And that's same goes with Cannaplanters, you know, all of that weirdness, all of that being uncomfortable or pretending to be comfortable, and that's played heavily into starting this company too.
Well, I hear that a lot. I think that one of the things that really kind of ties all of this up very nicely, and what I love about talking with Will and all of his enthusiasm, even as a guy who, you know, who never saw the Grateful Dead, right? He just missed it. And we've talked about this all the time, you know, but you're talking about music that spans generations, and you're talking about music that appeals to such a wide group of people. And, you know, even for me, I can sit here and say this. In fact, I'll give a quick shout out to my son, Matthew, who's in the clubhouse today listening to our show, who's a big Deadhead. And, you know, it just flows through the years. And so I've been trying to come up with interesting quotes. Here's my quote for the day from Garcia. He told Matt Donsler from the Philadelphia Bulletin, and this is, mind you, 1978. I think that even our younger fans are the same kind of people as the last generation of Deadheads. They're the seekers, the people who think there's more to it all than the regular rap. Now, that's 1978. I hadn't come on board yet. My younger brothers came on board after me. My kids have come on board after them. This is just generation after generation, and I think that really says is, what do all of us on this call have in common? We think there's something more to it all than the regular rap. And we, you know, we live that out by going to see bands like The Dead and Fish that play to that theme and say, no, it doesn't just have to be that way. There's other ways that it can be. And it attracts what I like to say are free thinkers like us, you know, who are just really taken in by that frame and way of life. And in that regard, Will, you know, it is great to have you on the show, and always nice to see that there's, you know, younger people who come to it with the exact same level of excitement, enthusiasm as I do, or Jim does, or Rob does, you know, and we're the old farts in the room. So, you know, good for you and good for everybody out there listening who's, you know, even if you're just discovering them today, you're never too late to the party.
Well, I will say that that's certainly one thing that you know, even John Mayer has had a huge impact on exposing that kind of, that music to a whole new group of people. And yeah, I'm with you. I've always been fascinated. You know, like I love the Grateful Dead. Their music is to me a a narration of American history in so many ways. But there's, you know, except for maybe like Willie Nelson, I can't think of some a band or a songwriter who is so embedded in the sonic nature of America than the Grateful Dead. And yeah.
But Rob, really quickly, can you give the listeners maybe a quick preview of what we have on tap for next week?
Yeah, I think next week we're going to talk about Pigpen. He passed away in March of 1973,
yep.
On March the 8th. So to celebrate Pigpen's life, I think we're going to talk about the influence that he had in the late 60s and the early 70s with just monsters like Love Light and Big Boss Man and Alligator.
I'll come back if you need. I'll talk Pigpen all day long.
Sure. So I was going to say, maybe we had to schedule a few extra hours for that one, but that's a great topic. And excellent. We look forward to that. So then I guess we'll head over to Clubhouse. Will, thank you again for joining us. Will Reed was our guest today. We really appreciate that. He's at Can of Planters. And Will, just really quickly, do you have web page or a email address that people can find you at?
Imagine being a web company without a web page.
Yeah, well, that's true.
That'd be awesome.
It would be. where do we find you?
Yeah, find us on all the social channels, including Clubhouse, at Can of Planters. Find us online at cannaplanners.com. That's cannaplanners.com. And then shoot me an email, info@cannaplanners.com. I'd be happy to talk to you about your cannabis business.
And one last thing from me, guys, as we sign off here, I would also be remiss if I didn't give a special shout out today to my father, Marvin Mishkin. It's his birthday. He's 90 years old today. Happy birthday, Dad. Jim Marty had a chance to meet my father a couple of years ago in St. Louis at one of the first cannabis conferences we had there. And it was actually a wonderful experience for me, because after all these years of being a cannabis attorney, and my father always kind of looked at me slightly askance, you know, what the hell are you doing? He came down, he heard me give a presentation. He saw people ask me questions afterwards. He got to walk through and see all of the exhibits. He met Jim Marty, and all he could say afterwards was, wow, this really is an industry, isn't it? And I was like, welcome to the party, Dad.
That's great. Yeah, that's a great story, and I really enjoyed meeting
you,
Dad. Thank
you. So happy birthday, Dad. And for all of our listeners, thanks for listening in. We will be back next week, but don't leave us and head over to Clubhouse where the conversation continues.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.